Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this group. I will be telling you about the work I've been doing here during my sabbatical. I've been here for about a year. And this work started some time ago, about 10 years ago, in the context of two-time physics, for which I have no time to tell you what it is about, but it is basically a theory of ordinary physics, but with a lot more gauge symmetry, where that gauge symmetry is in phase space rather than in position space. It restricts the theory a lot more. And by the end of choosing gauges and solving constraints and so on, you do come down to one-time physics with certain predictions. And so some of those predictions include local Weyl symmetry in the context of one-time physics. And it is that aspect, the local symmetry aspects, that created some new structure beyond the standard model, a little bit only beyond the standard model, which turned out to be attractive for cosmological purposes. And that coupled me to collaborate with Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok during my last sabbatical. So we wrote a series of papers on that that you can find in the internet. And by now, there were foundational questions and so on that I managed to settle in the intervening years. And what I'm talking about today is the work that I've been doing over the past year, and with all of this framework being applied to the quantum wave function. So now in the title, I said, that the wave function is around the beginning of the universe, around the singularity, understanding, in fact, the structure of the singularity and what goes on in that vicinity and also beyond, towards the past as well as the future. And of course, the goal is to go all the way to the present universe as well as well past. And for that also, there is progress that I will tell you, but it is in parentheses because there are still questions that need to be understood for which I will make certain approximations. Okay, so here is the outline. First, I will tell you about the effective field theory for cosmology, which is based on the well-known standard model coupled to general relativity, but improved with a Weyl symmetry. So I will show you what that is. And then I will limit higher curvature terms in this theory on the basis of the existence, possible existence, hopefully there is a theory of quantum gravity that will not allow those higher derivative terms to appear in the low energy physics when you try to understand what goes on close to the singularity. So I will tell you about that as well. So this theory is geodesically complete. So namely, it is valid at the singularity and past the singularity. And it is mathematically well behaved despite the travel through the singularity. So mostly I will be talking about the mini superspace of this theory, which is the usual standard mini superspace, where I allow all the important degrees of freedom for cosmology. So this will include the scale of the metric, the Higgs, which is part of the standard model, which does play a role in cosmology, as I will tell you, anisotropy, which is very important at the singularity, radiation and dark matter, curvature and dark energy. So the order in which I wrote them is not here, in the next, okay. So in the next transparency, I will tell you about the order in which they are important. I will be talking about global coordinates that are somewhat analogous to the Kruskal coordinates for the black hole. So namely, there are patches, and then we live in one of those patches. The future of the singularity is one of those patches. But there is a geodesically complete space-time, which is not taken into account in Einstein's theory, in the usual Einstein theory. That is only one patch of what I'm talking about. So I will show you what the global coordinates are in that sense, in a very similar sense to Kruskal Secure's coordinates. And then it is because of that, because the existence of that, that you are able to go travel past singularities and understand what goes on before and after singularities. So in this context, I will show analytic classical solutions as well as analytic quantum wave function solutions in the presence of all these degrees of freedom. And in particular, I will not assume any initial conditions at the singularity. The values of the fields and the behavior of the wave function at the singularity is completely predicted. It is not put in by hand at all. No matter what happens beyond the singularity, there is an attractor mechanism that pulls the degrees of freedom towards a particular point, almost a pinhole, in the space of the mini superspace, in such a way that initial conditions are just predicted; they are not assumed at all.
Question.
Yeah.
Isn't that exactly or as an approximation?
Within this effective field theory, within the effective field theory, it is exact.
But the
effective field theory is an approximation to something.
So you may tell me something that I have not of, but that would seem to either that, you know, the conditions now really are fixed and there's no condition of them, or the theory is non-unitary.
That's right. That's right. You cannot change the within this theory, which is, as I say, is mathematically well-behaved and manageable. Within that theory, initial conditions are fixed.
But also the conditions now are fixed.
The conditions now are fixed in the past. In the past, before the singularity.
There are no choices. Everything is exactly determined.
Well, there are some choices. I will make a choice, and you will see what it is.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, so I will show you what it is. But at the singularity, no assumptions. Okay, so there are issues when you are talking about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, ordering problems going from the classical constraints versus the quantum constraints. Those are, because of this global coordinates, are completely resolved. So I will show you what that is. I know that there is an interest in that for the group that has been working on the quantum aspects of cosmology. Then there are questions about, there will be questions on how you continue the wave function from one patch to the other within this global space, and then that is unique. I will show you the resolution. And it solves an old problem in quantum mechanics involving the singular 1 over r squared potential, if you are familiar with that. But in any case, potentials in quantum mechanics that are a little bit less singular than 1 over r squared, there is no problem. But once you reach 1 over r squared, there is a problem, it's a problem that goes back to von Neumann and not well resolved in quantum mechanics. It comes back in this context, and I resolve it in this context. There is also a unique resolution for that. So then I will show you the important effect of the anisotropy and of the Higgs potentials. And in their presence, it's very difficult to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I will need to make some approximations. I will give you some reasoning for what the approximation is going to be. And then within that approximation, then I will be able to give exact analytic results. At the end of this talk, I will tell you about some general lessons to be learned for quantum gravity, what quantum gravity should be, certain aspects of quantum gravity, what they should be. And there are also recommendations, including for string theory. And then I will also tell you about remaining open problems. Now, because we are talking about cosmology, let me go over very quickly about what phenomenologists have done with the phenomenological parametrization of what they see and the phenomenological parameters associated with that. So this is the Hubble parameter and the Hubble constant. which is set equal, in the Friedmann equation, is set equal to the energy density of the universe. And the important parameters in that are the dark energy, curvature, dark matter, radiation, the scalar, if you have a scalar in the theory, and anisotropy. So the order of these, for when A is large, when the scale factor is large, are such that the dominant term is dark energy. And the least dominant term, and there may be more terms, the least dominant term are the scalar and anisotropy terms. And then cosmologists have managed to fix some of these numbers. For example, about 70% is in dark energy, and about 30% is in dark matter. And the others are kind of small. For example, for curvature, they have a small number. It doesn't mean it is zero, but it is very small. And similarly, the scalar and anisotropy parameters, they are also small. They are not well known, but they have to fit within the error bars that phenomenologists have managed to set. But they are not necessarily zero. Now, in reverse order, if you are close to the singularity, no matter how small these parameters may be, as A goes to zero, clearly this is the dominant term over all others. So this is the dominant term. And in the order going backward here, the next important term is radiation. The next important term is dark matter. And then next comes curvature. And last is dark energy. So if you are interested in questions about what is going on close to the singularity, you need to pay big attention to anisotropy and what the scalar are doing. The scalar, in my case, is just the Higgs, the usual Higgs field. All right. So now, with that in mind, let me now tell you what the effective theory is. It is the usual standard model coupled to usual gravity, except that there is an improvement term because of Weyl symmetry. So symbolically, this is the action, the Lagrangian, for the usual standard model, including all the gauge fields, all the quarks and leptons, include also right-handed neutrinos, and include some candidate for dark matter. So all of that is in standard model Lagrangian. Then for the Higgs, H is the usual doublet, except that in this case, I will be using the SU2 cos U1 gauge symmetry to rotate it into just the singlet part, the little h. So, in addition to that, you have an additional field, phi. Because there is a Weyl symmetry, there is an additional scalar, which is a singlet of SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So it doesn't couple. It cannot couple to anything in this Lagrangian. Except maybe the right-handed neutrino and dark energy. It could couple to those. But SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 prevents this extra scalar singlet from coupling to the usual quarks and leptons, to usual matter that is familiar. It cannot couple to them because of that gauge symmetry. But it can couple to the Higgs in this way. What is different as compared to Einstein's theory is that there is no gravitational constant because I'm demanding a Weyl symmetry. A Weyl symmetry, which is a scale invariance, a local scale invariance, cannot allow any dimensionful parameters whatsoever anywhere in this Lagrangian. So here is the Weyl transformation. So the metric scales by this factor of a local function. This phi, as well as the Higgs, they scale with one factor of omega. The quarks and leptons, all fermions, scale with 3/2 factor. The gauge bosons do not transform at all. So under that, the only way to couple scalars is that they should be conformally coupled scalars. Only if they are conformally coupled scalars, you are able to maintain this Weyl symmetry. And what this means is that there is a relationship between the coefficient that multiplies each one of these scalar fields in the kinetic term versus this coefficient, this very special coefficient, in the way that it couples to curvature. So this is a unique Lagrangian as it stands. Now, of course, you could imagine adding higher derivative terms, such as higher curvature terms, r squared, and things like that. In a minute, I will give an argument why we should not have those for the purpose of doing cosmology. So now, there are virtues in this Lagrangian, which are quite important in my mind. So because I have a Weyl symmetry, I am able to eliminate one degree of freedom, one function I can eliminate by gauge fixing, because I have this function free to me. So I can choose a gauge that I will call the constant gauge, C gauge, in which I will take this field to just be a constant. I will choose other gauges also, but let me start with this one. So the virtue of this gauge is that it is the gauge in which you see low energy physics most clearly. So in this gauge, this term that multiplies r is just a constant, and then that constant will then be interpreted as being the gravitational constant. So phi zero basically is the Planck scale. Yes?
So that you have phi squared minus 2 h dagger h. That 2 is required to have conformal symmetry?
It's because h is complex versus phi being real. Yeah. So when I replace it with the little h, that 2 goes away. It multiplies with the 1 over root 2. So it will become phi squared minus little h squared. So gravitational constant emerges in this gauge. Now, if I look at this term, this is the Higgs potential, quartic Higgs potential. It can only be quartic. It cannot be anything else because of the conformal symmetry. Now you can see everything is positive. So therefore, the minimum of this term, of this potential, is only when h squared is equal to w squared times phi squared. Now, phi is Planck scale. However, h for low energy physics is of the order of 200 GeV or something. So therefore, in this term, this guy is much, much smaller as compared to phi squared. So as far as low energy physics is concerned, you don't even know. There is nothing that you can do with the current understanding of experiment to be able to detect that there is a small term there that modifies the gravitational constant. So that you cannot see in low energy physics. However, here, the minimum is when h squared is equal to, when h0 over root 2 is equal to w times phi 0. So w has to be very, very small. So since phi 0 is of the order 10 to the 19 GeV, then omega should be of the order of 10 to the minus 17, a dimensionless parameter. It's artificial. Yeah, you can criticize me for that. But unfortunately, we don't have an understanding of why there is such a hierarchy in the world as we know it now. And I'm not able to explain it. It's just a parameter in this effective theory. So therefore, now the scale of h0 clearly is related again to phi0. It's the same source. And finally, that last term when is just the cosmological constant. So therefore, the virtue of this way of introducing the Weyl symmetry for low energy physics is that you get to understand the constants that fill the universe. They have the same source. For me, this was a puzzle. I don't know if any of you wondered about that there are important constants that fill the universe, the entire universe. So the Higgs vacuum fills the entire universe. Dark energy fills the entire universe. And so does the gravitational constant. Why? Can there be all sorts of different sources for why they fill the entire universe? For me, it was a puzzle. And for me, this is a virtue of this approach, including the Weyl symmetry. So now, as I said, I could choose other gauges. And in fact, one gauge which must be considered is the one that everyone understands the physics in. And that's the one that gives you the Einstein form of the theory, the Einstein-Lagrangian. So I could choose a gauge in which this whole thing is a constant, rather than only this guy being a constant. And I can set this whole thing equal to the gravitational constant. And if I do that, so here there are two fields. If I set that that condition, then there is a remaining field. And that remaining field still has the interpretation of the Higgs, except that it is written in some complicated way. But in low energy physics, it still is the same approximation that I've already told you about. All right, so now that gauge, which I call the Einstein gauge, is actually a bad choice of gauge, a very bad choice of gauge. And the reason is that this guy, you can see there is this relative sign. It can be dynamically, it could become negative. Now, when it is positive, you can choose the Einstein gauge and call it the gravitational constant. But if dynamically there are patches of the universe in which this is negative, then you would have to interpret that term as being a negative gravitational constant. And therefore, it will be a patch in which you would have anti-gravity. OK, so which is totally unfamiliar from the perspective that we are familiar with, low energy physics perspective. So indeed, that change of sign, occurs naturally including in the constant gauge. For example, when this is just a constant and I still have the Higgs sitting over there, you can ask the question, can this sign change dynamically? So namely, if I allow the fields to do whatever they want by solving the differential equations for this action, will I ever find that if I start in a regime where this is positive, will I ever find that it becomes negative? So this was the form in which I started 10 years ago, asking that particular question. It was a question that came up in two-time physics as a prediction for one-time physics, that this is a prediction of one-time. And this is really what started me to think about cosmology.
Sorry, question.
Yeah.
So you could have assumed that the full thing is the constant as a case, couldn't you?
That's what I just said. So, but it can be positive or it can be negative. So if I choose only positive, I will be making a very bad choice. For cosmology, I will be making a very bad choice. Not for low energy physics. For low energy physics, it would be just perfect. But for cosmology, when I allow H to grow to the scales of the order of Planck length, so when this grows to the order of Planck length, if it can grow, you would have to investigate. So if it can grow to the order of Planck length, then this will be changing sign, and then you would have been making a very bad choice for cosmology. And unfortunately, this is what a lot of people are doing today when they are doing cosmology. They are using the Einstein theory, which is a bad gauge from this perspective.
Maybe not going anywhere, but let me quickly ask it. Mm-hmm. We'll ignore it if it doesn't go on. So is phi a dynamical field just restricted by this Lagrangian, or are there additional constraints on it?
In this gauge, it is not clear. It is not a dynamical
field. I'm not going to let you go there yet. So.
But the others are. Okay, this guy is dynamical. So this guy can grow past.
I'm asking about the definite, when you write down the Lagrangian with phi in it.
Yes.
You often define what your variables are.
Yeah. Here they are.
So that's just a free field, except it's restricted by the Lagrangian, no additional constraints?
No additional constraints.
Okay. That's right. Then the issue comes up, why are you calling this a gauge? Because symmetries of Lagrangian are generically not symmetries of symmetries.
Good. Good. So we will have to be interested only in gauge invariants. So at the end of the day, we are only interested only in gauge invariants. But to work it out, you can choose any gauge. And at the end of the day, figure out solutions that you get in whatever gauge you get, figure it out what it means for the gauge invariants. And that's what we do.
Ben, is there any justification for calling this gauge? I don't see one yet.
What, calling which? You will see the states. You will see the states. You will, let's keep them. You will see. You will see what they are. And you will see how I identify also the gauge invariants. So now, allowing this to change sign, or starting from here, from the very beginning, turns out to be geodesically complete. So namely, if you actually work out the theory, work out equations of motion, and figure out, does it change sign or doesn't change sign? It turns out it is generically the case that it will change sign very easily and most of the time. And it is the generic solution of the theory that it does change sign. So what happens if you work in the gauge in which this whole thing is a constant? That theory is geodesically incomplete. And so Einstein's theory is geodesically incomplete. So it is a problem in my mind for that theory. And so this modification makes it geodesically complete. So this is what we learned in those several years during which I collaborated with Steinhardt and Turok. So we generated all the solutions exactly in certain cases and showed that the generic thing indeed is that it is geodesically complete. So now, as I said, this form was predicted by two-time physics, but it's not only two-time physics. Also, as in the form that I just told you about, Weyl symmetry requires it, but not just Weyl symmetry, because there are various forms of doing Weyl symmetry. For example, you could say, I'm doing Weyl symmetry, but I will require that this is positive. That's still Weyl symmetry. Because under Weyl transformations, the sign cannot be changed. So you could say, as an additional condition to Weyl symmetry, I will require that this is positive. So anyway, you could do that, but Weyl symmetry plus geodesic completion is what also would predict. If you also require geodesic completion, it will also predict that you have that. And then let me also mention that if you go back to supergravity, you will see that supergravity is always written, including what is called the Kähler potential, in exactly this form. So namely, there is the Einstein term, and then there is a function of the fields that you, of the scalar fields that you have in supergravity with the same relative minus sign. Exactly that. So this has been in supergravity for many, many, many years, but people simply did not pay attention, did not understand that. You can look in Weinberg's third book on that includes supergravity, and he talks about this relative minus sign, and he says it's an embarrassment that it could change sign, but we will ignore it. So he does ignore it and makes a Weyl transformation and goes to the Einstein frame. And so this is how supergravity has been done. Supergravity, remember, is also predicted in string theory, but in string theory it is predicted only perturbatively. So whatever string theory, that the form of string theory that exists today, can give you a relative minus sign, but only for low energies, because they are doing perturbation theory. So string theory is being tested only for low energies.
Well, that's a little too much. Right, I mean, the low energy super actions certainly are positive. There's an e to the phi, e to the 2 phi convention that it can't ever change times in the usual type 2 or super actions, which aren't perturbative.
Yeah, I will come to string theory at the very end and tell you what to do, and tell you what to do in order to make it compatible with everything that I'm saying. Okay. String theory needs to be changed. Okay, so.
My problem is that if this becomes negative, then you have a ghost, which is...
Very good. I forgot to mention it. It's true. Now, what is the origin of this sign? The origin of the sign is also the same relative sign between the two. Now, the Higgs cannot be a ghost. It's a doublet on top of that. So it cannot be a ghost. So therefore, that sign goes together with that sign. But if I'm looking to generate the gravitational constant from this factor, this would be the wrong sign. for the gravitational constant. So the additional field that I am including has to come with the wrong sign for the kinetic energy so that I have the possibility of a positive gravitational constant. And so that is what gives you the relative minus sign. So now it is a ghost. Good. It is a ghost, but I have a Weyl symmetry. I have an extra gauge symmetry to remove that ghost. And indeed, in this gauge, it is explicitly removed. And you can only work with this gauge if you want to. But I will choose other gauges because I have the additional.
No, the problem is if that the full thing becomes negative.
There is what?
If the coefficient of R becomes negative, then your graviton has the wrong sign.
I will come to that as well. The graviton in that sector has the wrong sign. But the unitarity of the theory is determined by only the same degrees of freedom, those that have the correct sign. And then I will come to that. You will see it when I come there. Hopefully, I will remember to mention it. If not, remind me at the end, and I will go over that. So now we think, we hope, that there is a theory of quantum gravity. If there is a theory of quantum gravity, as I approach the singularity, the whatever quantum gravity is will take over this theory, right? So this theory is only an approximation. It's a low energy approximation to quantum gravity. So as I approach the singularity, this theory is going to take over. And therefore, whatever singularities that could appear to be in this theory are just going to become softer and softer as I hit the singularity. And so other degrees of freedom will take over. For example, string theory degrees of freedom will take over. So which means that if I allow in this theory higher derivative terms, R square terms and things like that, if I allow that, and those prevent me from understanding what is going on at the singularity, I should not allow them because quantum gravity will just make that softer and make it go away. So therefore, the most I will allow as far as singularities is concerned in this theory is what I just wrote. It's only this term in the Lagrange. So in the equations of motion, R mu nu will also happen in the equations of motion, so I will allow that. But higher curvatures are there. So if I have some metric that has singularities, higher curvatures, that metric does have that space, does have those higher curvatures, but they will not appear in my equations of motion. And because they will not appear in my equations of motion, this theory turns out to be under those conditions. So if I only work with this theory, as I wrote it, so this effective field theory for cosmology will turn out to be mathematically well-behaved and will be predictive at the singularity and beyond. So this is the reasoning for not allowing higher derivative terms in this Lagrange.
I don't follow you at all.
Okay.
Right, so it could be that you go beyond the regime, you want this to be an effective field theory. I mean, it could be as you approach what would look like a singularity to you, that your effective field theory breaks down, and okay, you have to go into whatever the bigger, better theory.
So what I'm saying is, yeah, there will be a new theory, which if we knew that theory, of course, we would work with that theory. Yeah. We don't know, we don't have it. I'm trying to do the best I can, coming from the low energy physics and defining a mathematically well-defined theory that allows me to go through the singularity. So therefore, you can trust this theory very, very close to the singularity. You may not trust completely at the singularity, but at least it will give you some result. At the end of the day, when we know more about the quantum theory of gravity, we will see how they compare. But at this point, I say this is the best you can do.
You need to say it's an assumption. You're
going to
claim that
it's more than an. It's more.
Including singularity.
I'm sorry. What is not an assumption is that I should not allow higher derivative terms, because if I allow higher derivative terms, it will contradict what the quantum theory of gravity will do. It will contradict quantum gravity of theory. Quantum theory of gravity will make those singularities go away, such as string theory.
Sure.
Okay. So if I allow higher derivative terms in this theory, that would be in contradiction.
Why? How do you know that there isn't? Well, there's also some definition of what do you exactly mean by higher derivative terms. But how do you know that there's not a higher derivative theory that resolves the singularity?
Well, show me one.
Well, I think so, but that's a longer story, probably over lunch. But I was just trying to get the assumption clear.
Okay, so the assumption here is that I'm giving this reasoning in order to say, this is the theory I'm going to work with. And that this theory, I'm announcing that this theory is mathematically well-behaved at singularities, and which is not evident. Is it evident? It's not.
It's true, but keep on going.
I think maybe.
I will let you believe what you like, but this is my talk, okay? Yes. And in this talk, based on this reasoning, I will not allow more terms, more curvature terms in this theory. So this is what I'm calling effective field theory for cosmology that I'm suggesting. Okay, so within this theory, now I'm going to give you results.
So could you just say then, I mean, the standard model part is a quantum theory. So could you say how you get rid of higher derivative terms coming from loops?
Of course, they are there from the perspective of the wrong theory, namely Einstein's theory. From that perspective, you do quantum corrections, and of course, you generate counter terms. But those counter terms should not play any role in determining what happens near the singularity. They will be just fine for low energy physics. As long as you are far away, you can take them as possible corrections. But they will not do the correct job. Okay, they will not do a correct job. They will be in contradiction with what you should expect from something like string theory. So for that reason, I'm appealing that eventually we need to go over to another theory, and I'm trying to approximate that theory from the perspective of low energy physics. So therefore, this is the best assumption I can make. So I'm keeping some curvature terms, and I'm banishing the others, because the moment you allow others, you cannot do anything at the singularity.
Singularities are not. I mean, are you just tuning the higher derivative terms to zero, or are you appealing to a symmetry?
I'm defining an effective theory for the purpose of cosmology, for the purpose of being able to say something definite at singularities. With this theory, I can say something definite at singularities. So I'm able to go that step further if I had not made that particular definition of what I think the correct theory is. So of course you can debate. It's fine. I mean, we should debate until we find the right answers. But with this theory, I will be able to make definite statements and predictions about what goes on. Okay, so I'm now going to define the mini superspace that I'm going to use. It is the usual mini superspace, but I will allow all sorts of degrees of freedom. So to start with, the metric, it has of course a factor, which is the scale factor. I'm pulling that factor all the way to the front. Usually it is kept only in front of the three-dimensional metric, so I'm pulling it all the way to the front. So therefore, the meaning of this time, x0, is what would be called conformal time, which eventually, if you choose the gauge in which this Laplace function, or related to Laplace function, if it is just one, which I can choose, so that this dx0 would be what is called conformal time. So x0 is related to conformal time. So now, the three-dimensional metric, I will allow anisotropy. So namely, in the different directions, x, y, z directions, you have different factors in front with a particular parametrization which was chosen a long time ago by Misner. So there are two functions of time, alpha 1 function of time and alpha 2 function of time, which are degrees of freedom in addition to the A. So all of this is coming from the metric. So it was already in the previous transparency. So I take that action that you saw in the previous transparency and make a dimensional reduction to only time. So an assumption of homogeneity. So under an assumption of homogeneity, the degrees of freedom now are A and alpha 1 and alpha 2, the Higgs, H, and the phi. And there still is a scale invariance, which is only time dependent. Omega is only time dependent. So this form of this kinetic energy is scale invariant. It comes directly from the R term. This is all coming from the R term, including the phi squared minus h squared that was multiplying the R term. So now, in addition, there is also this potential for all these degrees of freedom. Let me emphasize, there is a difference in my definitions of x0 and tau by a scale. That scale, I choose it to be the it is the conformal time, but written in units of the Hubble time. And the reason for that is that I want to relate to those same coefficients that I mentioned in the phenomenological Lagrangian with the same values that phenomenologists use. So it is only for that purpose. So the potential includes terms that come from the Higgs potential, that quartic Higgs potential that was there, a term that comes from the curvature term, phi squared minus h squared, multiplying it, that has to do with curvature. So this is a potential that, again, was obtained by Misner a long time ago. And then this omega is radiation combined with all the matter in the standard model, quarks, leptons, gluons, photons, all of that, but also if there are neutrinos and also if there is dark energy. So all of that at the high scales, close to the singularity, they are all conformally invariant. So I treat all of that, including dark matter. So including dark matter, they are all conformally invariant to begin with in that Lagrangian. So I treat all of them as conformal dust. So this parameter is like the radiation parameter, but including the dark energy. All right, so this is the standard model matter treated as conformal dust. All right. So now a little bit more detail. Phi squared minus h squared squared times this f, that whole thing, is the Higgs potential multiplied by the square root of g. Okay, square root of g gives you an a to the fourth in front of it. So all of that, I pulled out this factor in front because it is convenient for later. And so this defines for me this function of h over phi. H over phi is invariant under these transformations, under the Weyl. So h over phi is Weyl invariant. Phi squared minus h squared, phi squared, phi or h are not Weyl invariant, but h over phi is Weyl invariant. Then a times phi, as well as a times h, again under these transformations, they are all also Weyl invariant. So all these combinations that appear here or here, they are all Weyl invariants. The alphas do not transform under the Weyl transformations. So this whole thing is also Weyl invariant. So here I have identified under this definition of units, I have identified the dark energy parameter, the thing that is 0.7. And then this thing in the range of 0.3. Okay, or 0.31, because it includes a little bit more than just dark matter. And so the other parameters, now this omega lambda, this lambda is the coupling in front of the Higgs quartic term. So it is huge as compared to that one. So this is of the order of 10 to the 120 or so. So it is much bigger, this term is much, much bigger as compared to that. But there will be a very important thing happening, that just after the electroweak phase transition, you will be sitting at the bottom at the minimum of the potential for the Higgs potential, which means that this factor is going to be exactly zero once you make a transition after the electroweak phase transition. So therefore, this term will just drop out, even though it is multiplied by a very large term. And then just after that, so it will be governed. So this whole term will be governed by just the cosmological constant. Now, further than that, this is really should be not the bare Higgs potential, but it should be the renormalized Higgs potential. And in the past, several years, ever since the Higgs became real, people have worked on trying to understand the renormalization of this potential, which means that this parameter and that parameter and that parameter need to be renormalized. Now, the renormalization will imply, because of the biosymmetry, will imply that these are functions of the logarithm of h over phi. It's the only way that it's going to be wide invariant. However, now these parameters, the renormalization part of it, is known only in low orders of perturbation theory. So it is limited. Our knowledge of it is limited. But even with that, we have learned that there are possibilities that the Higgs is not going to sit exactly at this minimum, but rather that there can be other non-trivial minima close to the gravitational scale. Now, I'm not going to push that particular point of view, although we wrote a paper together with Neil and Paul about that possibility. How is it that the Higgs could drive cosmology? I will not go into that, not for this talk. But I want to tell you that this function is not as simple as it looks only like this. It is true that once I am at the electroweak phase transition, that this term will just drop out despite the renormalization. It will drop out. But if you are not very close to the electroweak phase transition, this could be a rather complicated function of h over phi, which could play important roles. But I will not be able to tell you much about what that role is going to be. I mean, I can tell you words, but not real mathematical work. All right, so now then the other potential is this one for anisotropy. So it's a complicated form. I will tell you a little bit more about it. It was understood by Misner. So Misner is the one that parameterized it like that and gave this potential. It has not been used seriously. In my opinion, it should be used rather seriously, and I will say a few words about that. It can be that because of this potential, we see very small anisotropy in the universe, because this potential can trap the anisotropy to be very, very small because of being trapped in the potential. And I will say in a minute how. I went a little bit. I included here in this metric. I included all the possibilities for Bianchi 1 and Bianchi 9 and Bianchi 8, which corresponds to, in usual cosmology, when they tell you that there is curvature, that there is this parameter that is either 0 or plus 1 or minus 1. So that little parameter k is also included. That's an improvement over what Misner had done. So anyway, now Misner had talked about a mixed master universe because of this potential. And he had argued that it is very difficult for the universe to grow because of this potential, and that the universe is going to be trapped, the entire universe, not just anisotropy, the entire universe is going to be trapped in this potential. And then he called that a mixed master universe, which was a problem. Now, later it was understood, although still only a few people seem to be aware, that according to BKL, and also later by Nicolai et al. In a paper that they called Cosmological Billiards, these are smaller remarks in those papers, that as long as if you have an additional scalar in the theory, then it is possible to avoid the mixed master universe. And in fact, by explicit computation, I show that because of the Higgs, you can avoid the mixed master universe. So there is no mixed master universe, but the potential still can play an important role. All right, so I told you about one gauge and also about the Einstein gauge. Now I will tell you another gauge, which I call the gamma gauge, which is a gauge that gives you the global parameters of the space-time and of the mini space. So that gauge is out of the three fields that I have, A and phi and h. I could have chosen, I said phi, let phi be a constant. In this gauge, I'm going to say let A be a constant. So when I say A is a constant, you know, all the curvatures are zero. Okay, so I don't have curvature singularity, but of course I have shifted the singularity somewhere else. Now, it is because of this shifting that is possible under Weyl transformations. So when you have a Weyl symmetry, curvatures are not invariant under Weyl transformations. They change. Okay, they are invariant under general relativity transformations, general coordinate, but they do change under Weyl transformations. So I can go to a gauge in which the geometry is really simple, and I shift whatever singularity there is, I shift it somewhere else. But in this other form, it can be much easier to understand what goes on at the singularity, and this is what happens. This is the usefulness of this, and also gives you a global space in mini superspace. It gives you a global space that goes beyond the singularity. So here it is. In the gamma gauge, the previous mini superspace that was Weyl invariant version just becomes that. Phi and h appear. At least as far as this term is concerned, like free fields. If I didn't have anisotropy, this part of the kinetic energy, it would be free fields. With anisotropy, it is not. But this is where phi squared minus h squared, the vanishing of the phi squared minus h squared can come. But this phi and this h, are really, they should have a sub gamma in it. They are not in the same gauge as say, Einstein gauge. They are in a different gauge. So in that form, you can look at the equation of motion for E. That gives you the constraint. The constraint is equivalent to the Friedmann equation. And the constraint equal to zero is what should be used in order to solve both classical and quantum equations. And you can see now that phi squared minus h squared can appear in the denominator. And that is the singularity. OK, so namely, singularity is going to occur. It's not clear yet. I will say one more thing. The singularity in the Einstein gauge, so namely A in the Einstein gauge equal to zero, that one in the Einstein gauge equal to zero, is equal, can happen only when phi squared is equal to h squared. So namely, only when that coefficient in front of R vanishes, which means the effective gravitational constant becomes infinite. Okay, so when the effective gravitational constant becomes infinite, that's when you have the singularity in the Einstein frame. Okay, so therefore, one sign of that, let's say the positive sign, which is our part of the universe, our patch of the universe, will happen when this vanishes and continues to remain positive in the evolution.
Shouldn't there be another constraint associated with the Weyl symmetry?
Say again?
Shouldn't there be another constraint associated with the Weyl symmetry?
Once I choose a gauge, it is being resolved. And there is no more.
Yeah, but the Einstein constraints come from diffeomorphism invariance. I mean, even if you fix the gauge, there's still Einstein constraints. Yeah. The Weyl symmetry, there would be one.
There is, if I keep all three degrees of freedom, if I say A and phi and h, they are all included, then in that language, there is a constraint. And that constraint is that under Weyl transformations, you know, the operator under Weyl transformations would be in any gauge, will be A pi A, and then plus maybe, yeah, this, and then phi pi phi, and then h pi h. So this is the scale, the operator of scale transformations. So this is the operator that will generate local scale transformations, this equal to zero. OK, so that is the constraint. That's the constraint you are asking about. This is when I allow all of them to be present. You could work with that, but that you will be having gauge degrees of freedom in the theory. So if I choose this gauge, then this constraint is solved. So when this is one in that gauge, so you get to solve for pi a in terms of the others, but pi a doesn't appear.
Okay.
Okay. So all right. So now the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is imposing this not only at the classical level, but at the quantum level. Pi is a derivative with respect to phi, pi h is a derivative with respect to h, and so on. So it just gives you this differential equation. So now, in other forms of degrees of freedom, when the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is written in terms of other forms of degrees, there are questions of ordering. So how do you order your pi's and phi's and so on with one another? In this case, there is no such question. You can see, okay? So pi just becomes a derivative. Pi h becomes another derivative. Pi 1 and pi 2, which is the different degrees of freedom than phi and h, commute with that. So there is no ordering problem. And so with these degrees of freedom, the ordering problem is resolved. And I say, these were my original degrees of freedom in the Lagrangian from the very beginning. And these are also the global degrees of freedom. It's not just in a patch. These are the global degrees of freedom. So this resolves the ordering problem for the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I prefer to define the quantum theory and the ordering of the quantum theory in terms of these degrees of freedom rather than any other. And so once I define my Wheeler-DeWitt equation, then it defines it also for any other change of degrees of freedom, which I will do in the next transparency. So now, as I said, I did mention the Einstein gauge, or you can say the Einstein frame by making a transformation from one gauge to the other. So in the Einstein gauge, I will have an A in front of my metric, and I will call that A sub E, okay? A sub E, which is different than the gauge in which I just talked about, the phi sub gamma and h sub gamma. So if you make a transformation from the E gauge to the gamma gauge, then you will learn that A squared is equal to phi squared minus h squared in absolute value. Now, phi squared minus h squared has a sign, right? But in absolute value is the A squared of the Einstein gauge. So when in the Einstein gauge you get a singularity at A equal to 0, that is in the gamma gauge, what happens is that phi squared becomes equal to h squared. Now, here is the parametrization that I will like to choose in the Einstein gauge so that I overcome this problem of sitting only in one patch. I want to be able to cover both signs of phi squared minus h squared. So I will define a z, which is phi squared minus h squared, a sigma, which is a ratio of a function of h over phi. The range of these z and sigma are both from minus infinity to plus infinity. In terms of the original phi and h, I can define what is just like light cone coordinates. Remember, phi and h, their kinetic energy was looking like just free fields. So I can define something called u and something called v, and then define this plot, which is the global space of for mini superspace phi and h, and then u and v, just light cone. So phi squared minus h squared is 0 only on these 45 degree lines, only on the light cone. When phi is larger than h, so when this is positive, when z is positive, you are in this quadrant or in that quadrant, okay? When phi squared is larger than h squared. So this is in this quadrant, and in that quadrant you have gravity. And then in this quadrant and that quadrant, h is larger than phi, so here you have anti-gravity. So this is the full space, the full global space. And this transformation is really analogous to the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate transformation. So you can work with u and v, or phi and h, or you can work with z and sigma. When you are working with z and sigma, you are basically doing Einstein gauge, except that I'm doing Einstein gauge, but covering both patches, both the positive and negative patches, which are both gravity. So in this space, in this global space, region 1, 2, 3, 4, just like in a black hole, region 4 will be past to the singularity. Remember, singularity is the 45 degree. Okay, the 45 degree lines is the singularity. Region 4 will be the past before singularity. So the horizons here, the horizons, will correspond to z equal to 0, which is when a is 0. So that is going to be the crunch, okay? A big crunch. So if the universe is here, it evolves towards the crunch, which is approaching the 45 degree lines. Then it can go to region 1 or 3, which means it goes to anti-gravity. And then from after that, it goes again into a singularity, and that is the Big Bang. And then after the Big Bang, it passes to the current age of the universe. All right, so this is the geodesically complete version. Now, with phi and h, you can describe everything. But with z, you know, when z is positive, it can be either here or here. So using all the z and sigma doesn't give the full global space, because when you say z is positive, you can be either there or there. So you have to say more, a little bit more, to be able to say that you are there or that you are there. Are you in the past or are you in the future of singularities? So you do need the phi and h in order to be able to tell uniquely where you are. So the description really should be given in terms of phi and h. And so this is what I will do in order to give you a full description. So the mini superspace is now written in terms of z and sigma, like this. And then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation then takes this form. And you can see there is an ordering over there that really came from dz, z, dz, okay, in that order, d by dz times z times d by dz. It came from that. And this is what emerges from the ordering that I already had given you in terms of phi and h. All right, so the challenge is now to solve this equation. So in this equation, notice several interesting things. That in this kinetic energy of the Higgs and anisotropy, there is an accidental SO3 in that kinetic energy. You can rotate the three of them and without changing that term. However, this form of the potentials will break that symmetry. However, if you are close to the singularity, if you are anywhere near these 45 degree lines, z is approaching 0. Z is approaching 0. And because of that, the potentials become unimportant. Okay, when you are very, very close to the singularity, the potentials become unimportant. And the whole thing gets dominated by this kinetic term. But they all are of the same order of magnitude. And then next to that, it is the radiation and dark matter. And then after that come the potentials. So the solution of this equation is very easy at small z. All you do is you go to momentum space for these variables. This becomes a constant. And then you have a simple differential equation, simple second order differential equation, whose solution tells you exactly what is going on very close to the singularities. Now, you will see the role of z equal to 0 and the role of curvature and why it is that I banished the higher derivative terms. Okay, so you will see in trying to solve this equation. Now, before I go to that, let me also say something about the role of the potentials. So the Wheeler-DeWitt equation I just showed you is in the space, let's call that position space, z, sigma, alpha 1, and alpha 2. Z plays the role of time. If you are in region 2 and in region 4, which is where you have gravity, in those regions, z plays the role of time, and sigma, alpha 1, and alpha 2 play the role of a three-dimensional space. So that differential equation has this form, where I have identified h sigma, where you have a kinetic term for sigma, as well as a potential term, and also for anisotropy. So let me start by talking about the anisotropy potential. So this potential here, this function, has the form, roughly speaking, of an upside down pyramid, triangular pyramid. It's an upside down huge pyramid. And this is taking slices from the top and then going down and down and down and eventually reaching the vertex of the pyramid. Now, this overall, the overall equation, because of this z dependence there and this z dependence, all of that, can be viewed as a Hamiltonian that is time dependent. It's a time dependent problem. And I'm just solving something analogous to a Klein-Gordon equation, but where the time parameter appears in several places. So it's a time dependent Hamiltonian. So what do degrees of freedom do when they are in a time-dependent Hamiltonian, when they are exposed to a potential? So what they do normally, any such degree of freedom in a time-dependent potential, no matter where they are, they just bounce around the potential, and slowly they just go down to the bottom. They just want to go to the ground state of that system. So anisotropy degrees of freedom would like to go down to the bottom of the anisotropy potential. And on top of that, if you look at this z, as z grows, as you get away from the singularity, the importance of the potential becomes more and more important. So therefore, anisotropy gets trapped even stronger as you get away from the singularity. So I think this needs to be explored really much more deeply. As a possible explanation for why anisotropy is small in the universe that we see today. Now, I cannot do that. So instead, I will do an approximation. So what I will do is I will imagine that this transition will take place very quickly as we get away from the singularity. Remember, close to the singularity, the potentials play no role. As we get away, it's going to play this role that I just mentioned, and then quickly go to the bottom. So I will assume I am at the bottom. I will not understand the transition. So I will just, kind of wave it, hand wave it away, and just say you go to the bottom of the potential. Now, if you are at the bottom of the potential, then this V is going to be replaced just by the value of the potential at the very bottom, which is just a constant. So when this is just a constant in the whole equation, I just have only the kinetic terms that I showed you before here. When this V is just a constant, I just have kinetic terms plus the potential being replaced by a constant. And same thing I will argue also for the Higgs. So as I approach the electroweak phase transition, which is very early in the universe, the Higgs would like to go down to the bottom. In fact, this is something in the work that I did with Paul and Neil. We did that numerically. And indeed, this is exactly what the Higgs does. It starts somewhere, and then very quickly, it just goes down to the bottom and sits for a long time, which is including up to today, it sits at the bottom of that potential. So therefore, I will simply replace these by constants. When I replace them by constants, it just becomes an equation only in Z. And I will show you what that looks like.
Itzhak?
Yep.
How much longer will you talk?
I am in number 8. I have 16.
Okay.
I will go quickly.
Well, we're already over time. How much longer do you think it will take? Because I'm wondering if it might be better to continue next week, depending on how much more you have to say.
I'll go quickly.
Okay.
Just so that I give the main message. And then if there are people that want me to say more, I'll be happy to say more. In an additional session. Is that okay? Okay, so this is what I will do. So replace the potentials by the constants. The constants turn out to be these phenomenological parameters that appear in usual. The omega k, which is very small, omega c, which is about 0.3, omega lambda, which is about 0.7. So then I can go now to momentum space and replace this by another constant, which is p squared. So therefore, here is the form of the equation I need to solve. I rewrite psi with an extra square root of z in front of it. The reason for that is to absorb the effect of that, so that I have a Schrodinger-like, non-relativistic Schrodinger-like equation to solve with zero eigenvalue and the potential, which involves only these phenomenological parameters. The shape of this potential is this. So what happens when Z is large and positive, you have the universe developing and approaching the singularity, which is zero, then passes the singularity and hits a wall, then gets reflected from that wall. So it cannot go far into anti-gravity because there is this wall. This potential creates this wall. It cannot go far into the negative region. So it bounces back, passes from zero again. So this was the crunch and then hit the wall. Then come back and then big bang and then goes into region two, which is the future. So just based on the potential, this is the qualitative version of what goes on with the solution. So the actual solution takes the following form. This thing, S is now alpha 1, alpha 2, and sigma. P is the canonical conjugates, P1, P2, and P3, which appear in Fourier transform. So multiplies the solution as a function of Z, which is this structure. So this function, when close to the singularity, starts with 1, and then order of Z, and so on. So it's a series in Z that starts with 1. In simple cases, when some of these parameters are set to 0, then it is just the combined thing is just a Bessel function. Bessel function with a funny argument. But they are simple functions. Otherwise, it is more like hypergeometric function, F0, 1, or F1, 1 type of function. So explicit functions. I don't know the exact solution when all parameters are non-zero, but I know many of the solutions exactly, analytically, when some of the parameters are set to 0. OK, so now this behavior, analytic behavior, Z to some complex power, where the complex power is P, is very unique. It occurs in every case. And it is because of this term, 1 over z squared term. That is the dominant term at z equal to 0. It is because of that that the solution takes this form and then multiplied by a constant. So now this 1 over z squared, I mentioned at the beginning that it was a big problem for the 1 over r squared potential. It is very tricky to be able to tell how do you go from the patch when z is positive to the patch in which z is negative. How do you continue this wave function from this patch to that patch? Now, there wouldn't be such a problem if I was working in the global space with phi and h. But with phi and h, I cannot solve it. I can solve it in terms of z and sigma. But I figured out what it is, and it is unique. So I don't have the time to explain why it is unique. But it is an old problem that gets solved in this context. So now I also can solve exactly the classical solutions for that. The classical solutions are in terms of Jacobi elliptic functions. They are complete solutions. No parameters are left out. For initial conditions, nothing. So I have the solution for Z as well as for S, and it takes this form. Z comes from infinity, hits zero, goes down to a minimum in the negative region. That was the wall, and then comes back, and then goes again to infinity. So big crunch, big bang, anti-gravity regime, and then go to infinity. Now, the Jacobi functions are periodic. They're doubly periodic. And it turns out one period in this conformal time is infinite in the usual cosmic time. So cosmic observers can see only one full period of this solution. But I'm not really sure what the physical significance could be. That there is a repeating again and again. So I'm not sure what that exactly means. I will give a hint of what it might mean. So now, if I just look at this portion only, I will also give you what S does. Okay, S, which was anisotropy and the Higgs. So when the blue line, which is z, hits zero at the singularity, s goes to infinity. So this is a theorem that I want to state. By the way, this is also plotting now, eliminating tau between these functions, eliminating tau, and using z as time, and then s as space. And so, and this is the trajectory in z as space. So it comes from z comes from infinity, hits zero, goes negative, goes again to zero, and then goes positive. In the meantime, when z is going to zero, s is going either to plus infinity or to minus infinity. So now this is a theorem. It will always happen. When z is zero, in the E frame, the E frame variables, the Einstein frame variables, anisotropy and the scalar go to infinity. And this is relevant to the work that you guys have been doing. And I will mention that maybe privately if there is no time. Otherwise, that's the relevant part I want to say about that could help you. Now, those plots can also be done in the global space. So in the global space, this is what happens. You have a cone. You have a cone. That cone is the circle, the angle in this cone is defined by the direction of that momentum that I mentioned. So the classical motion happens in a slice of that cone on a plane. And so what happens is that the universe comes from infinity, and it doesn't pass, okay? It doesn't pass the 45-degree lines, the z equal to zero lines. It doesn't pass it in arbitrary places. And that is because of anisotropy. There is an attractor mechanism that no matter where it's coming from, it's always attracted to the origin here. And it goes tangentially. It hits z equal to zero tangentially, goes into anti-gravity, and again tangentially reemerges. And so this is, again, is another theorem. So the behavior of anisotropy, how it becomes huge, or in this plot, how the universe needs to pass through a pinhole. Okay, so in these degrees of freedom, in the global degrees of freedom, it needs to pass through a pinhole. But it passes, and I can know, and this is the mathematical aspect that I can do, provided I limit those curvature terms. If I don't limit the curvature terms, then I don't know. I mean, I didn't even try. Okay, so maybe someone else can try adding additional curvature terms and then tell me how you can do it. I think you cannot do it. So this is the reason. This is the only reason why I needed to limit the curvature terms. So when I do limit it, I can do it analytically, and you can find the exact answer. So this is what defines the initial conditions dynamically. Okay, dynamically. It doesn't matter where I start in the past. It just doesn't matter. It just attracts it to the origin. And at the origin, there is this pinhole that tells you exactly what the values of every degree of freedom is. Now, this happens also for the wave function. So that was classical. So it also happens for the wave function. The basis of the, I already told you what it was. But the full wave function, it can be rewritten in terms of this u and v as well. And in terms of the u and v, is how you do the analytic continuation going from this region to that region to that region in terms of the u and the v. So u and v correspond to basically the 45-degree lines. It so happens that when you are passing through here, either u is zero or v is zero. Like when you are passing like that, okay, you are tangential to this, which means u is zero. And when you are passing towards the future, then v is zero. So these solutions, the basis of solutions were written in terms of u and v, is one of the solutions is proportional to u to a complex power, and the other solution is proportional to v to a complex power. Now, these oscillate very wildly, okay? So when u is approaching zero, so this becomes an infinitely oscillating wave function. And the problem of the past is, well, it doesn't have any definite value. Okay, it doesn't have any definite value because it's just oscillating infinite number of times as it approaches zero. So how do you pass it from one side to the other side. How do you pass it from the gravity to the anti-gravity if you don't know the value at the singularity? And there is a nice tricky thing that I found for how you can do that. And it has to do with the wave function, with the complete solution, including the coefficients that you need to multiply it with. So you take the basis functions, you multiply it with the coefficients. If you give me time, I will explain. But the point is that now there is, in region two, you have a solution, full solution with some coefficients. In region either one or three, you have a solution, which a priori is different coefficients. And in region four, a priori also different coefficients. So these are different solutions. And you don't have the right to say that they are related to one another because of this problem that I just mentioned. Because of this widely oscillating version of the basis. But it turns out I know how to do it. And for those of you that want, I can tell you, but there will be papers on this. So it turns out the same A and B in all regions get determined, and the wave function is completely analytically continued from all over the entire space. So now what remains next is to put asymptotic boundary conditions. Okay, so there are no boundary conditions to be given at all at the origin. So that's completely determined. But there are asymptotic boundary conditions that in the past, coming from the past, you want only an incoming wave function. You don't want both incoming and outgoing. And in the future, you want only outgoing. So it turns out if I fix only incoming boundary condition, it also determines that the next one, the outgoing, is automatic. So I don't need additional conditions. So therefore, so in the past, if I demand, by the way, the significance of this A and B are that when I am close to the singularity, they do, S is one, close to the singularity. And the form of this is basically like a plane wave, okay? Where this is like the space part of the plane wave, and this is like the time part of the plane wave, like the energy part of the plane wave. So this is like positive energy solution. This is like negative energy solution. And then the significance of A and B is that they are the analogs of creation annihilation operators for plane waves at the horizons, just like in a black hole. You can do the same. So now, asymptotically, for the physics of cosmology, we want something different. So we want only incoming waves, which are not necessarily just plane waves. So therefore, you can impose that boundary conditions by going to asymptotically in z. Okay, so you can ask in z as a function of z the asymptotic form of this, and then demand that there is only an incoming wave. What this does is puts a relationship between the b and the a, where the b and the a were at the horizons. This is the condition for incoming boundary conditions in the asymptotic past. Now, finally, there is one additional thing. I told you before that we need to sit at the bottom of the potentials. And that I needed to do an approximation. I neglected the potentials. I replaced them by a constant. But we still need to remember that we need to sit at the bottom of the potentials. Sitting at the bottom of the potentials means that these momenta, canonical degrees of freedom, cannot be infinitely large. You are in the ground state of the wave function. And to imitate that, we need to restrict the momenta not to become very large. So therefore, for the remaining form of A, therefore I take a form in which each one, either the momentum for the Higgs or the momenta for the anisotropy, that they are Gaussian distributions. And the parameters are the phenomenological parameters that we were talked about before. So with that restriction, A and B are given except for one overall normalization constant. So with all of that, the simplified wave function has only phenomenological parameters in it. And it is given definitely in terms of the functions that I mentioned before, where the combination of what remains is an incoming wave in the past, an outgoing wave in the past, analytic continuations of those for the anti-gravity version. The analytic continuations go from z positive to z negative. When z is negative, they become, rather than oscillating, being oscillating, here they are oscillating and here they are oscillating. But in that intermediate region of anti-gravity, they are going to zero exponentially. So that means they cannot go beyond the wall, not too far. OK, so that's the form. And that's the end, really, of what I managed to do up to now. So I want to repeat that this effective field theory for cosmology is mathematically well behaved, and it makes predictions. So it is geodesically complete. This I put it as a challenge for quantum gravity theories, whatever they are. I have not seen other quantum gravity theories that are geodesically complete, and I think it is important. Here it is possible, and it's a challenge, for example, for string theory. In the case of string theory, we did show how you can have a field theory, a string theory that will have as low energy physics will give you the Lagrangian that I showed, the effective Lagrangian that I showed for low energy physics. And so the trick for that is to impose local Weyl symmetry in target space of string theory. So to be able to do that, I have to eliminate any dimension-full parameters in string theory. String theory does have one dimension-full parameter, and that's the slope, alpha prime. And that needs to be replaced by a field, just like I did in the low-energy physics. And we showed in this paper, we showed how you can do that. So it is possible for string theory, and I believe string theories should give some attention to that. So then the other thing, which I had no time to tell you, is that the analyticity, this z to some complex power at the horizons, is such that it gives you an infinite number of complex planes in the z plane. I mean, an infinite stack of in the complex z plane, you have an infinite stack. So with a cut. So you can going around the cut, you can go from one to the other to the other. So going from z positive to z negative, you need to go through that cut. So in principle, there are an infinite number of stacks of complex planes that represent, in this language, represent like different universes. Different universes. So when you go from positive to negative in this language, there is the possibility of going from one universe to the other, to the other, to the other. And that may have something to do with that periodicity that I said in the classical solution. So anyway, for this, I wrote a paper in a much simpler case, just Rindler space, usual Rindler space, which is just flat space. Okay, so how you can have flat space and then the extended Rindler space, all four regions, and how you encounter exactly the same problem, which is common also to Rindler space. And so I have a very large paper, unfortunately too large, but you can look at it and try to make sense, physical sense of that. So there is mathematical sense, but the physical aspects of that still remain to be well understood. Now, things that need to be done better than what I managed to do includes taking the Higgs and the anisotropy potential, taking them seriously, and see whether there are mechanisms in there that resemble inflation that could be useful. Now, inflation is an attractive idea, but the way it's been done, I don't like it at all. Because it makes huge assumptions. Not only the potential is arbitrary, but also the solutions, the initial conditions for the solutions are so totally arbitrary that is, for me, you know, it's difficult to trust that what is being done really has something to do with nature. It's just the wish of the person who is writing those papers. So I've been looking, if I can, to find some natural way if there is anything like inflation, that it might happen in some natural way. I think this is a place to look, in particular during for the sigma potential for the Higgs potential during the anti-gravity phase. Because in the anti-gravity phase, the Higgs cannot go. It cannot go to the bottom. Only in the gravity phases, it can go to the bottom, and then it's consistent with the approximation I made. But in the anti-gravity phase, it cannot go to the bottom, and there is something more complicated than what I said that can happen. So it is worth investigating that. And also investigating whether the anisotropy and also inhomogeneity in those infinite potentials, whether it can be explained, whether inhomogeneity is also a natural thing. There are some papers that say because of the of this infinite anisotropy potential, it's not only anisotropy that will remain small, but also inhomogeneous terms also will tend to become smaller, smaller and smaller dynamically while it bounces. But in homogeneity degrees of freedom bounds in this potential as well. Now, then finally, there is investigating inhomogeneous small perturbations. So far, everything is homogeneous in everything that I said. But now it's the wave function. It's not the classical, just it's the wave function. So allow inhomogeneities in the wave function and investigate what they do, in particular, is the spectrum of perturbations. Would it fit what works in nature? Now, there are these questions that were raised by Neil and group, including Yab, that when they do the work that they did, that they find that these inhomogeneous perturbations actually tend to become larger than the background. Say again?
In a lambda-dominated universe.
But lambda is dominated in everything that I just showed you, and I have more parameters compared to what you did. Now, the thing is, the perturbations are becoming large, but they did have the tendency from the very beginning, not only for the homogeneous part, but for the homogeneous part, they have the tendency to become infinite, not just large, infinite in what I showed you. So it is, in my opinion, for the work that you guys have done, it's very important that you include in the background, in the homogeneous background, that you include anisotropy. And take into account what the story that I just told you about, that it is infinite. And then when you do make inhomogeneous perturbations on top of that, you already will have an infinite background at the singularity, which of course will become smaller, but you have something which is large to begin with. And then it is natural to expect that the inhomogeneous parts also will not be able to dominate the background. So that's what I think would work also in your work. I suggest that take a look at that. I will also be looking at that, but from the perspective of the wave function, as opposed to what you do, which is a different story, which is the propagator. I can also look at the propagator because I have all the solutions. I have the full set of solutions, so propagator also is easily done in my case. Okay, this is the full story. Thank you for thank you for listening, and I'm so sorry more than half an hour late. So